The second contribution of the Roman law jurors was to reinterpret the basic Roman law concept of merum imperium, that is to say, the highest form of public power, especially the power to use violence, to command armies, and also the power to make laws. Originally, the Roman law codes seemed to assign this form of authority, unsurprisingly, to the emperor alone. But many of the subsequent commentators argued that the same range of jurisdictional authority, including the so-called right of the sword, could be exercised by people who were called inferior magistrates, that is to say, other officials of the crown or of the state below, immediately below the level of the monarch himself. This argument about inferior magistrates, as they were called, was particularly influential in the Holy Roman Empire, that area which we now call Germany. The reason for this was that the Holy Roman Empire was not, unlike France, unlike Spain, unlike England, it was not a hereditary monarchy. It was an elective monarchy. The emperor was always elected by seven powerful princes who were called electors, unsurprisingly, and he swore a coronation oath upon being elected. The doctrine of inferior magistrates could therefore be mobilized in the Holy Roman Empire to provide two distinct arguments for constitutionalism. First of all, it provided a kind of contractual reading of the imperial constitution. The electors could be argued to be bearers of the sword, no less than the emperor himself. And second of all, the emperor's coronation oath could be seen as a kind of contract, an obligation that he had with the electors, so that if the emperor should fail to observe the terms of the original oath, the electors had the right to use force against him. And in fact, this theory was actually put into practice in the year 1400, when the emperor Wenzel was deposed by the imperial electors. I should note here that the emperor Wenzel is not to be confused with good King Wenceslas, who was also deposed in a sense, but was a 9th century figure who was killed by his own people in Prague with less explicit political theorization. At any rate, the resort to the doctrine of inferior magistrates was quite easy in the Holy Roman Empire because the electors were obvious candidates. If you were looking for who would the natural inferior magistrates be, it was clearly the electors who were there. But actually, even outside of the Holy Roman Empire, the doctrine of inferior magistrates could be used to support a constitutional argument in a monarchy without an electoral structure. The argument that was advanced also worked on this kind of corporeal model of the body politic, this idea that every member of the body politic, every member of a body, has a duty under natural law to maintain the integrity of the whole. And indeed, this goes back, at least indirectly, to an old Aesop's fable about different parts of the body disputing over who is going to be the head of it all. And it ultimately comes down to the fact that if they don't all cooperate, they all have some responsibility for keeping the body going. This analysis of this sort of corporeal metaphor of political societies was taken to mean that inferior magistrates, acting as members of the body politic, had a duty to defend the well-being of the body as a whole. And this would therefore give them the power to do something against a tyrannical monarch. There's a third source of constitutional ideas, which we touched on at the end of the last lecture, and this is natural law, especially natural law coming from the Neo-Thomist Catholic tradition. As I mentioned in the last lecture, the Neo-Thomists are, by basic inclination, monarchists. They like absolutist kinds of polities. But nonetheless, they did make several very important contributions to constitutional theory. And in large part, through this principle that the universe is governed by a hierarchy of laws. The most important kinds of laws were eternal law, or the eternal law, which is the law, according to the Neo-Thomists, by which God himself acts. Underneath, in the pyramid, eternal law, comes divine law, which is a law by which God reveals himself to his children, for example, in scriptures. Underneath divine law, again, comes natural law, which is a kind of law which the Neo-Thomists argue is directly implanted, it's hardwired, to use the contemporary metaphor, in human beings by God, so that they can understand God's designs. And then last, on the very bottom of the heap, comes positive law, that is to say, the actual pieces of paper or legislation which men themselves ordain on earth. The whole point about the hierarchy of laws, unsurprisingly enough, was that positive law is valid only to the extent that it's compatible with natural law. That is to say, the higher kinds of law always override the lower kinds of law. To quote Francisco Suarez, the Spanish Jesuit on this matter, he says, "A law not characterized by natural justice or righteousness is not a law, has no binding force, and must never be obeyed." Strong words. It's no wonder that James I had his books burned. Now, Neo-Thomists argued that natural law embodied both the will and the reason of God. This seems like an abstruse kind of point, and we might wonder, why should anybody really care about this? But it's worth stressing because it relates to the nature of moral.